You're listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of Too Much Magic, The Long Emergency, and The World Made by Hand novels.
Welcome to the KunstlerCast. Thanks for listening to my podcast. It's great to be here. It's great to be anywhere. It's been 4 weeks since I had a coronary bypass, and I'm feeling a lot closer to normal now. I dropped in on the surgeon this week. He wanted to check me out 4 weeks out. He admired his work and seemed to regard me as a good advertisement for a coronary bypass. And so that's sort of out of the way. Spring is here, yay. I planted a couple of blight-resistant American chestnut trees last week and a bunch of hazelnut trees. They're really kind of large bushes. They never really get to be really big trees, but I'm glad I got them. I planted some additional pear trees, a bunch of additional berry bushes. Grapes will be coming soon. The peas are going in this week, so spring is really happening out there. The three-bay compost bin is completed. Next project is the new chicken house. And a few apologies about today's broadcast. I'm still working out the bugs technically with recording. I think my new method for recording is getting a little bit better. But today I had a couple of coughing spasms during the interview, and I just couldn't edit them out. So bear with them and forgive me for doing that. Today I'm having a chat with independent energy analyst Bill Powers, who's the author of a new book about the shale gas situation, titled Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark. And it's being published by New Society Books. Should be out around May 1st. And I've maintained in my own books and in my blogs that the public is being hosed by a massive PR disinformation campaign, the purpose of which is to put over the story that we have 100 years of shale gas and that we will soon be energy independent, neither of which is true, and all of which is prompting the American public to be extremely complacent about our situation, which I don't think is a good thing, because the American public ought to be a lot more concerned about how we are going to manage our economy, and in particular, manage what will prove to be a more or less permanently contracting economy that will require new arrangements for daily life. So, Bill Powers is a maverick among energy commentators. He's his own man with his own ideas, and our nation needs more brave independent thinkers like him. So, here's my conversation with Bill Powers, author of the forthcoming new book, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark. The American public has been played by a massive PR campaign to promote the idea that we don't face any problems over oil and gas resources. And I have my own theories about how this has been managed and how the public has been swindled, but what's your idea?
Well, one of the things that I talk about in my upcoming book is that the U.S. does not have a 100-year supply of natural gas, and yet this is the myth that has been played out in the mainstream media and elsewhere, that the U.S. has an unending supply of cheap natural gas, and this is just simply not true. The evidence does not support this. The U.S., is, unbeknownst to many, is a net importer of natural gas, even though we are the biggest producer in the world.
Where's the propaganda coming from exactly?
Well, it's coming from a few areas. I mean, one, we look at the government. The EIA has, you know, through their efforts to reduce the amount of coal used to produce electricity, has really pushed the natural gas agenda. We've seen it from companies themselves who are looking to sell the company at a higher price to a buyout or to do a farm out with a foreign company looking to get involved in North American shale. And then we've seen it some from academia, where we've seen some academics write papers that are basically industry-sponsored research.
There's tons of advertising during the 6 to 7 o'clock news hour on the cable news networks, coming from the oil industry, and that's obviously aimed at the kind of people who vote, you know, elderly people. I wonder how much. What's your thought about that?
Well, I mean, part of it is that the industry really wants to keep the mainstream media focused on its message, which is we have a lot of natural gas, that we're on our way to energy independence, and that's so that this is important. This is an important resource that's going to bring jobs back to America, and by doing all of the advertisements, they really reduce the likelihood of a negative news piece being done on them. It's really kind of a way of buying the media, if you for lack of a better term.
How much of this is aimed at generating investment money for their project?
I would say some of it is, but a lot of it is really just focused on the ability of these, the desire of these companies to promote the idea that that America's natural gas resources is a key link to our energy independence, and that anything that stands in the way of them developing this resource is really not a good idea. And that's really what I think the message of the industry has been and continues to be to a large extent.
Well, natural gas has been in a price range under the economic development range that would make it worthwhile to produce for a long time. For going on maybe 2 years now, it's been under what I think is the $8 floor for what would make it worthwhile to actually drill and produce this stuff. This has gone on for a long time. So they seem to be just sort of giving away their product.
Well, part of it, I think the floor is a little lower than that, but it's not.
What was it, $6?
It's somewhere between, I would say, $5 and $8, depending on the field you're talking about. But really what is important is that they've been producing gas at a cost that encourage that is below the cost to produce. So right now we've got, this is starting to reverse itself. We've seen companies really reduce the number of active rigs, and we've seen the EIA report that production is starting to fall in a number of areas throughout the country. And, specifically in the Haynesville and Louisiana, that production is really starting to come down there. And so we are seeing the gas is, it's been close to $4 lately, here in late March, early April. I think that the storage situation is much improved from where it was a year ago. We have, we're getting close to the 5-year average for storage for this time of year.
Bill, excuse me. Would you explain to the listeners what the storage cycle is?
Well, in the winter, we consume more gas than we produce, so we withdraw from the storage caverns throughout throughout the country.
Wait a minute. You say storage caverns. What are they exactly?
They're basically salt there most of the storage is depleted natural gas fields. So that is what most storage is.
So they're what, salt caves or salt strata?
Some, depending on where you are, that can be the case, yes.
Okay, go on.
So basically what we have is, and then in the summertime, we produce more than we consume, so we inject into storage. So there is an ebb and flow of storage of, throughout the year. And so historically, there's been a pattern at certain levels for certain times of the year. And over the last couple of years, since, partially because we've been producing more gas than we consume on an annualized basis, we've seen storage get to unusually high levels at times, and this has reversed itself, and it's now back to where it should be for this time of year. So there is we are seeing an upward bias to gas prices, and I think that this is something that is really going to help bring out the idea that maybe gas prices are not going to stay at this level for the foreseeable future.
But they're there now, and I'm wondering, how has this been affecting investment in the shale gas sector?
We still have not seen prices high enough to encourage investment in the sector. We're still seeing prices too low to really encourage investment. It's something that I think we're going to need to see higher prices.
Well, this raises the question, though, Bill. If investment is lagging, and this is an enterprise that requires a huge amount of capital investment, it's very expensive to be bringing all this steel out into the countryside and all these drilling rigs and all the trucks and the water and the fracking fluid and all that. I mean, how exactly do they manage to do this if investment is lagging?
Well, I mean, basically what we're seeing is a lot of companies have sold off assets. They've issued stock. They've gone into debt. That's really what's occurred in the industry over the last several years.
Well, you know, this raises a question. Some people I've talked to have referred to the shale gas industry as kind of a real estate leasing Ponzi scheme. Around of leases being the main way that these guys are making money at the moment.
That's one way that there's been a lot of desire for companies to promote their project, sell off part of it, recapture their costs. That's been a big part of what the industry, of part of the promotion behind the industry, has occurred. So, you know, there is that aspect to it, that I think is, I would say, somewhat distorted the importance of shale gas over the last few years.
Can you explain to the listeners what the leasing situation is in the shale gas industry and how that works?
Sure. What happens when a company wants to lease acreage that it intends to drill on? It will approach the landowner and offer a bonus, which, depending on the size, could be anywhere from a few thousand to several million dollars. And then it will sign a lease to drill on that land for the next, and it has usually between 3 and 5 years to do it. So the company is very incented to drill on that land because once it has a producing well on the land, it holds that land as long as that well is producing. So the land is said to be held by production. So a lot of wells were drilled over the last 3 to 4 years that were uneconomic simply to hold land so that you would not have to approach the landowner again and try to either extend your lease or negotiate a new lease, and it would have involved write-downs from, if land was written off, and companies really didn't want to do that. So we've really seen a movement now that most land is already held by production. you know, where companies are much less likely to drill uneconomic wells to hold land right now. So that's been a big change we've seen in the last year or so.
Well, there are clauses in a lot of these leasing contracts that say that if the company doesn't get a project underway by a certain date, then the lease is essentially canceled. And this has been a big matter of controversy in New York State, where a lot of people in the southern tier, where the Marcellus shale gas extends into, have been complaining that that the New York State moratorium on drilling will prevent them from keeping their leases.
That is correct. There has been the issue where before fracking was banned in New York State, that there had been leases that had been taken out that are going to be difficult, and that are either, I don't know the exact situation of what's going on, but it's going to be, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that at this time.
The poster child for problems in the shale gas industry over the last several years has been the Chesapeake Company, which was run by a dashing fellow named Aubrey McClendon, who got onto 60 Minutes and made big claims for the shale gas industry, and then proceeded over a period of a couple of years to get into an awful lot of trouble with his company. Can you tell us, give us a sort of capsule history of Chesapeake and what happened, where they are now?
Sure. They started about 20 years ago, and they've, you know, been very big, and they were one of the first companies that really got into shale gas. Leasing for shale gas. They were, however, what their method, what they typically would do is they would try to lease up as much acreage as possible, and then bring in a partner. And what this often involved was a lot of promotions of their plays, and they've taken on a lot of debt to do it. And now the low gas prices and their drilling requirements in the last few years has, you know, put the company in a lot of debt, and now they've gone through. McClendon has left the company, and
was he forced out?
I believe so. Yes, they have some new board members, and some. I believe Carl Icahn has become active in the company, as well as a couple other shareholders, and forcing some changes. So the company is, has really, I would say, found it difficult to manage through the low gas prices that they kind of helped to create through the aggressive drilling, and you know, they took on a lot of debt to drill wells, and as well as took on partners that in their joint venture agreements, they were required to drill a certain number of wells per year, irrespective of gas prices.
One of the questions that I wonder about is, you know, it's been discovered over the years that these vast areas of the shale gas plays, which come under names like Haynesville and Fayetteville and Marcellus, actually have rather limited and small sweet spots where the drilling really pays off, and the rest of the plays are not really particularly economical. What is the situation in the Haynesville and the Fayetteville shale plays now? I understood that they were kind of petering out over the last 12 months and that they're in decline.
Yes, as far as the Haynesville, it is certainly in decline. You know, we've seen the number of rigs drilling there has really dropped off. We've seen the same thing happen in the Fayetteville, but not to the same extent, because the wells that are drilled in the Fayetteville don't decline as quickly as they do in the Haynesville.
Do they have a different geological characteristic?
Yes, they're not quite as high a pressure, and they don't have as much as initial production, and they aren't quite as expensive to drill. So the Haynesville wells, they produce about 80% of their entire ultimate recovery within the first 2 years. So they have very steep decline rates, and after the first 2 years, the wells are marginal at best, and it's a very difficult business when you have to replace that much declining production every year.
How does the Marcellus stack up compared to these others like the Barnett and the Haynesville? There seems to be a kind of idea out there that the Marcellus is extra super special and that it has more sweet spots and it's sort of basically can't be depleted. But I have a feeling that's not true.
Well, it's every field has its limits, and so does the Marcellus. Due to the fact that there's been around 5,500 wells drilled into the Marcellus so far, we've seen production really grow rapidly over the last 5 years. However, one of the things we are now, finding the limits of where it's economic to drill, and there's been two sweet spots, one in the southwest corner of Pennsylvania and part of West Virginia, as well as in the north central part of the state, have really been the two main sweet spots where we've seen a lot of drilling activity. So while the Marcellus is going to be one of the biggest fields in the country and it's certainly a great asset, we don't know how big it is and we don't know exactly where the limits of the field are as of yet. However, I think a lot of the projections that have been put forward are unrealistic as far as the size of the field, simply because, where we know it, that Marcellus is going to work would not justify some of the numbers that have been put forward.
Are you acquainted with Nate Hagans?
A little bit.
Okay, so you know who he is. He said the other day on the internet that he described the Ponzi action in the shale oil and gas sector and the way it works as using credit to borrow future energy, pulling it forward to mask what's really happening in the overall energy picture of the world, and in particular the U.S., which is to say a kind of failure to really increase production in a significant way.
Well, one of the things that we see when we apply a lot of technology to oil and gas reservoirs is that you can produce oil and gas faster, and we're seeing that happen here in some of these unconventional oil and gas fields, especially in shale gas, and we've seen the rapid depletion of some of these fields, such as the Haynesville, and this is it. While you can get production up, it's just not sustainable at current levels, and that's what I think I wrote my book about. Is that while we've seen a big boost in gas production, it's not going to be sustainable over the long term, and that we will be producing less gas in years going forward than we are today.
Nicole Foss, who is an economic commentator on the web, believes that unconventional oil and gas will founder on the financial model that it's based on, that in essence, the money, the capital is not really going to be there to develop the resources at the rate that we need to develop them to keep our oil and gas dependent culture going the way it wants to go. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, we are going to see higher prices, and higher prices will kill off demand. And demand, and that means lower, and it's either going to require increased efficiency or lower economic activity. So there will be changes in the way we live, as prices go up. And so, there may be some truth to that, as far as, high prices are definitely going to change people's behavior.
You know, some people I've been reading, I think it's Dmitry Orlov and others, have made the point that efficiency is kind of a canard, and that it's important to make a distinction between efficiency and forced conservation. And I think partly because Jevons' paradox comes into play with efficiency, where, a resource, you have an energy resource and you learn to use it more efficiently, but that ends up only provoking you to use more of it.
Well, in the very immediate term, it probably, I can see where you're going, there is some truth to that. However, one of the things that we've seen consumption of oil in the United States decline, and some of that has to do with obviously more fuel efficient cars and other things, which I think are a very good thing. So efficiency is definitely something that we are going to have to embrace and use it to drop our overall consumption. And that Jevons paradox is true at the margin, I think. But as you get substantially higher prices, of gasoline were to go to $6, $7, $8, you would certainly see increased efficiency in consumption patterns.
Well, there are a lot of fantasies abroad in America these days, and one of them is that we are going to run the happy motoring system by other means. In particular, the idea that it will possibly run on either all electric cars or on natural gas cars. Now, personally, I don't think it's going to play out that way. I don't think the capital is going to be there to produce the kind of infrastructure necessary for the natural gas, transport idea. And I don't think the capital is going to be there to allow Americans to buy much more expensive electric cars the way that Americans are used to buying them, namely on installment loans. Because as we, there's a relationship between energy scarcity and capital scarcity. And as we move further into capital scarcity, there will be fewer car loans available to people and fewer qualified borrowers. So where do you see the motoring system going in the years ahead?
Well, I see it moving towards electric cars. I think that, right now fossil fuels are going to be more difficult. And the way I see what I really see moving forward is solar panels on garages as well as using the increased use of batteries to store energy when it is available, such as, during the day, having a garage that feeds into a battery that then could charge the car in the evening.
Well, hold on, hold your horses just a second.
Sure.
But the whole picture that you're presenting there is an extremely capital-intensive picture of a citizen, or as we call them, consumers, who are able to lay out, let's say, $10,000 for a solar array and a battery bank and the charge controllers and all the electronics in order to buy a car that's going to cost a third again more than an internal combustion engine. And it leads me to the conclusion that we're talking about a much smaller number of Americans who will be privileged to be drivers.
Yeah, I would agree with you that there will be, as prices go up, we will see fewer drivers. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Doesn't that become a political problem?
It does, and that is a different that is certainly becomes a political problem. But I think that technology is improving enough to make some of these things competitive. I don't know, whether we will, how much we will embrace them, but I think it is something that we're going to see more of.
Well, because there's another angle of the capital scarcity issue, which is that municipalities and counties and states and even the federal government in one way or another are going broke. And I wonder how they're going to maintain this fantastic hierarchy of roadways that we've got going.
I mean, that's a good question. At this time, I don't know how we're going to be able to do that. I mean, I think there's going to be a number of ways that, we're going to see things change. I mean, I know a number of counties are letting some of their roads turn into gravel.
Yeah, it's a kind of a triage process where they make a determination that they're going to depave the roads.
Correct. And that's happened in a number of counties. I think we will probably see more of that over the next several years. I think there's a number of things that are happening around the country that where counties are running into problems and, you know, just letting their roads go. And so that's something that, you know, I think we'll see more of, certainly.
What is the drill rig situation now with the shale gas fields vis-a-vis the North Dakota shale oil fields? I understood that at a certain point a lot of the steel was moving out of the shale gas and moving up to the Bakken.
Yes, that's been underway for several years now. And, you know, right now we've seen the rig count in the Bakken decline somewhat as you know, as producers have drilled their leases to hold production, to hold their leases by production. So, you know, basically there's a kind of a glut of rigs, now in North America. And, but we've continued to see shale gas drilling decline over the last several years.
Does that mean that the rig count is generally down all over?
It's down, really down in as far as gas-directed drilling, but it's off from its highs for oil drilling.
Could you explain to the listeners what's the significance of the rig count and what it means?
Okay, what the rig count means is how many people are actually going out and drilling for natural gas. Each drill rig will produce between 10 and 20 wells a year. And this is just a level of industry activity. So it's the rig count is a reflection of how active companies are in drilling new wells.
So if the rig count is way down, does that mean that the action in both the shale gas and shale oil sectors is somewhat depressed at the moment?
Yes, it is. I mean, the level of activity is down substantially from previous levels. Yes,
I believe I noticed in one of the bulletins that came out over the last 60 days that the production rates of shale oil in the Bakken actually went down in late 2012 for the first time in quite a couple of years, I think. Did you notice that?
Correct. I mean, we have seen a flattening of production in the Bakken. This is the field that's had a lot of wells drilled into it that is has rapid decline rates and you know it has basically stopped growing. And this is what happens when you drill a lot of wells in a unconventional gas field. You have to it becomes a treadmill that you just have to keep drilling more and more wells every year to keep production flat. And that's the situation we find ourselves in the Bakken as of right now.
Is the situation in the Bakken a little bit ominous in terms of our expectations for what that will produce?
Well, I think it's, time will tell, right now the peak production rate is where I think we're starting to see it right now in the Bakken. We're either close to it or we're rapidly approaching it.
And that rate is somewhere around, 750,000 barrels a day?
Approximately.
Because approximately. The propaganda out there has been telling people that the Bakken will eventually produce millions of barrels a day, and it's not really looking like that.
It's extremely unlikely, given the what we're seeing right now, the high decline rates of the wells. We're starting to see operators, find the edges of the field, and so it's very unlikely we will get to even a million barrels. I mean, I think around 700,000 is where it is right now, and I don't see it going materially above that.
So when you say at the margins, let's say you got an operator who's on a sweet spot, and he moves 1,000 yards to the west, and all of a sudden the production drops.
Correct. I mean, that's very likely, or it doesn't produce anything at all. That happens. If you look at what happened in Montana is a very good example, is that, we saw that was where the first horizontal wells were drilled into the Bakken in around 2000. In 2006, production peaked at around 100,000 barrels a day for the entire state, with about 70,000 coming from the Bakken. And production's dropped down to 60,000 barrels, and a lot of that just has to do with that the Bakken production in Montana has already peaked. And so that's something that I think is very important for, you know, people to kind of see that as a model for what is potentially going to happen in North Dakota, is that these fields peak early in their life, and you know, once they do, it's there's not much you can do to reverse it.
Well, if they're at, let's say, about 750,000 barrels a day, and by the way, I don't know if listeners know, we use about 18, 19 million barrels a day in the USA. We actually used to use about 20 million barrels a day back in about 2005 and 6, but that has gone, demand has really gone down, and not necessarily because of efficiency, partly because the American middle class is in the process of being impoverished, and they can just, you know, spend less money for oil and oil products like gasoline. But if they're at 750,000 now and they've reached a peak, what do you suppose the depletion arc is going to look like for the Bakken from here?
That's a real good question. You know, a lot of it's going to depend on the quality of the remaining drill sites. And that's something.
What's the chatter in the industry about that?
You know, the chatter is, you know, there, you know, it's, this is kind of one of the big unknowns is what's the, you know, historically, operators or companies will drill their best wells first. And, you know, and so I, you know, the second 5,000 wells you drill are probably not going to be as good as the first 5,000 wells. So, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, the historical pattern, you know, it does not indicate that the next wells, that over the next several years, the number of wells that will be coming online are going to be as good as the wells that came on the last 5 years. So this is something that I think is very important to understand. And what this means for production rates, it probably means they're going to be heading down, but the rate at which, you know, the arc of that is yet to be determined.
Do you suppose the American people are going to feel terribly disappointed when they learn that we're probably not going to be energy independent in the way they've been told?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, part of it is that, you know, we've been hearing about this energy independence for 40 plus years now. So I think that while some people, you know, have, you know, I would say, regenerated hope that this is a possibility, it will become apparent that it is something that is going to be seen as increasingly unlikely once we see the Bakken start to decline in the Eagle Ford in Texas, which is another unconventional oil field, start to decline, which, you know, once those become visible to the public, I think that they're, you know, a lot of people will kind of give up on that idea.
Do you have any conclusions about what that might mean for us politically, socially, economically?
Well, I think, you know, we're heading towards an era of decreased, I would say right now there's a lot of optimism about our energy future. I think we're going to see a period of decreased energy optimism. I mean, a lot of people like to talk about the, you know, the boon that we've had from, you know, cheap natural gas over the last several years. This is not going to be sustainable. This is going to cause a lot of problems, and I think there's going to be, you know, as energy prices rise, especially for electricity prices rise and home heating prices rise, these are all going to impact, you know, people socially, and I think it's going to have a lot of implications out there. So it's something to definitely keep an eye on.
Well, you're the author of the forthcoming book, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, published by New Society. When's that coming out?
It should be out May 1st is when we are expecting it to be off the press.
What prompted you to write that?
Well, really the big disconnect that I was seeing between what the industry is saying and what about shale gas and the possibilities of shale gas and what my own research was telling me, that, you know, these are important fields, but they're not going to change the world, and they're not going to have the impact that many in the industry believed or were saying they would have. So that's really what generated the idea for the book.
Well, okie dokie, and thanks very much, and we will ride again.
All right, Jim.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you so much. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
All right.
You've been listening to The ConcertCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. Send email to jim@concertcast.com. You can interact with other listeners, hear previous episodes, and find out more about this podcast at concertcast.com.